Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted to be joined by Seb Stafford-Bloor. Hi, Seb.
All right there, Joe Devine.
I am fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
A big day of football, wasn't
it? Big day of football.
Yeah. And a big day of football to be joined by the Goblin's hero. It's John McKenzie. Hey, John. How you doing, buddy?
Yeah. Do you really want me to do that?
No, listen, you're not the Goblin. As discussed, you aren't the Goblin. You are just the hero,
the hero of the goblins.
Maybe because you've emancipated the Goblins. Maybe you've enabled the Goblins to, I don't know, get normal jobs like bank teller or ferry people.
You know?
I don't know what normal jobs are, but maybe that's why. And anyway, you're going to help us today by talking a lot about the football and not at all about goblins. But what are we going to talk about today, John? Well, we're going to talk about South Korea and Portugal, aren't we? We're going to talk about Uruguay and Ghana, Switzerland, Serbia. That game's just happened. And of course, Brazil, Cameroon, although that one didn't matter as much. And a bit later, you're going to tell us, John, aren't you, all about how FIFA rankings work.
Yes. My favourite.
Yeah. Is that why you're in a bit grumpy this morning?
No, absolutely not. The idea of talking about really complex ranking systems excites me.
That's what we love to hear. There we go. And if you're excited by complex ranking systems, then you might enjoy The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. TheAthletic.com/TIFO, where no subject is too complicated to be conquered by one of the writers here. Yeah? Actually, that's not far
that
off true, is it?
Really nice.
That
well
was pretty
done.
Good. Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks, guys. Thanks. Anyway, there you go. You can get The Athletic right now for £1 a month for 6 months. So go and try it out. Please do that. And with that in mind, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of the Goblin's hero. Yes, where else to begin? But with South Korea 2-1 Portugal, John. This is a bit of a surprise.
Yes, although this was another one of those games where one of the teams had already qualified. And so they fielded a weakened side. So, yes, it was unexpected, I suppose. But when you consider that the Portuguese put out a second string team and Cristiano Ronaldo, who got an assist, actually, although for the wrong team, which was, I think, the most enjoyable aspect of this game. But, yeah, went 1-1 for a very long time. And then right at the end, the Korean Republic got a really nice transition goal. So Son Heung-min with a really, really lovely pass to Hwang. And that changed things around and meant that Korea Republic go through to the next stage of the tournament, which is quite fun.
That's pretty cool. Well, listen, I've just put a poll in the live chat to ask how far Korea Republic can go in the tournament. I'm quite excited to hear. So maybe we'll come back to that a little bit later. But Seb, it's nice to watch a game at this point in which, because there were a couple today where the result actually ended up not mattering or not impacting the outcome at all. It was nice to watch a game where there was a change of placement within the group, because of course, South Korea now going through in their group second place on 4 points. And I believe they're going to face, who is it they're going to face? They were second in Group H. They're going to face Brazil.
Oof,
in
difficult.
The next round, as far as I'm aware, which is a quite exciting for any football fan.
Yeah, so this also involved one of my favourite football tropes, Joe, which is when you have a match on the third group game, the third match in the group, and one of them finishes early and they need something from the other game to fall their way to progress. You get a huddle of players in the centre circle. They've done everything they can. They've won their game. and they're waiting for confirmation, and the TV camera kind of settles in them, and you see the moment of confirmation, and you see the mass moment of celebration as well amongst the South Korean players. Also, if you haven't seen it, try and find Mauricio Pochettino's reaction to South Korea's second goal. It's very, very lovely. It's like him watching one of his own team scoring. Obviously, he has a lot of residual affection for Son Heung-min after their time at Tottenham together. And I think he particularly enjoyed Son's through ball for Hwang to score. And it's great. It's like, I think one of the things we've talked about a couple of times over the past few days is the stories within it. We said last night that this has been a very macro tournament in terms of the themes that we've discussed, but this was just old-fashioned football story, which is unfancied nation or underdog nation in a specific game, upset the odds, go through, clearly means an awful lot. There's some wonderful pictures of some of the South Korean players in tears. Also, clearly what it meant an awful lot to some of the South Korean fans, because some of their supporters were in tears at the end as well.
That's You've great. Started to point out in the last couple of days how much you enjoy it when people cry.
Yeah, but in happy tears, not happy tears. Not bad. I'm not like, I don't want to see crying children. No. Like that. I just,
sure.
People overcome by emotion, because that's a very affecting scene, but also like it's a... it feels like we need a little bit more in that tournament, because it feels very far away in many ways. And it also feels like it's kind of snapped its moorings for what a World Cup is supposed to be, in my opinion.
It's also happened, as far as I have seen, almost exclusively to the you know, quote, smaller teams at the tournament. So you can understand why a victory or a loss may mean more. Can I ask you a question?
Yes, of course.
Have you ever cried at a football game?
I was when Lucas Moura scored his winner in Amsterdam. I was strangely emotional about that.
Right.
That was very, I didn't bawl or anything, but I don't get emotional about football usually, but I was then.
Right.
Because it was so, it just doesn't happen to Tottenham, does it?
In Amsterdam, was that the semi-final?
Yeah, semi-final of the Champions League in 2019. And it was just, it was very, very overwhelming. It wasn't actually the moment itself, it was the way that everyone responded to it, Pochettino in tears at the end, and what it clearly meant to some of the players, and hearing Jermaine Genus cry in the commentary box during his commentary, when I think, I always forget his first name, but Fletch, the BT commentator.
It's Darren Fletcher,
Darren
isn't it?
Fletcher, that's it, that's him, yep. And sorry, Steve McManaman always just calls him Fletch.
Sure.
Anyway, he was trying to get a response from Jermaine Genus during the commentary, and he was just sort of gone. It was very lovely.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was. But this was like, I don't know, like I think World Cups, in the lead up to a World Cup, we talk about who's going to win, right? Who the favorites are, who's going to knock out who in the semifinals, like, you know, who should the 25th man out of 26 be in the England team. I think sometimes we forget that World Cups are built from these kind of moments. Like if you look back at stories from the past, yes, you remember who won and who was the top scorer and that kind of stuff and who missed the penalty. But I think also you remember the symbolism of the games and what individual moments meant to fans who, in a lot of cases, have spent a lot of money going to watch their teams, in many cases have experienced logistical difficulties too. And then you see that moment where for them it is worthwhile. And that's very, very powerful.
Have you cried at a football match, John?
No.
Why is that?
I guess I'm not a really football crying kind of guy. I don't know. I've been emotional games.
What's the most emotional that you found yourself at a football game?
I remember being at Elland Road for the loss to Derby County. Oof. When we were going to for promotion the first season under Marcelo Bielsa. And that was like shell shock, I would say, that emotion. I think I mentioned before that I was at the game where Leicester City lifted the Premier League title and Andrea Bocelli sang. That was emotional in a different way.
That was
way.
Lovely.
Yes.
But no, I've never really been much of a crier in that sense. I cry at like films and like watching Jack Grealish be a decent human being with kids.
Sure.
But yeah, not really at the football. I don't know. Maybe I'm too stoic for that.
I don't think so. Misery in football doesn't necessarily cause you to cry. It causes that sort of, that feeling you get of blood turning cold in your body. So yeah. I remember one of my earliest and most painful football memories was England losing the Euro 96 semi-final and penalties to Germany. And I remember that feeling. You don't burst into tears. Well, some people might, and that's all good. But I think for most people, it's just that kind of numbness that you get rather than a kind of an actual tearfulness. The tearfulness generally comes from stuff which is about a little bit more than just the football, yeah. I think. As are the things that John's just described.
I'm also a Leeds fan, so I've not really had anything to cry happy tears about.
No.
So, yeah. No. But definitely that feeling of like numbness that you've talked about there, where nothing really makes sense. I think that was the thing that hit me in the Derby County game, is that we were absolutely cruising and then suddenly we ended up losing the game and you're just sort of like, what? And then you go from this situation where you're like, oh, we're going to go to Wembley to the playoff final, and then to, oh, well, here we are at Elland Road and we'll be back here again next year playing Millwall.
Yeah. I've always thought that actually the playoffs is among the cruelest moments in football, because like, it's not just you've lost a cup competition and next year you might have another 6 games or 7 games to actually get back to a final. It's a, well, you've got another entire season of slogging through the Championship or League One or League Two to get back to where you've been.
That's rough, isn't it?
Brutal. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of times where I've been emotional watching football. I think during the Euros last year with what happened to Christian Eriksen, that was very difficult. That was extremely difficult to watch, but also the way his teammates stood around him was very moving.
I remember when that happened, when we were all here together, and I remember there was that scene where you could see what was happening to him.
Yeah.
And it was just horrible. I remember going outside. We have an office just by the river. And I remember walking down by the river just because it's just nasty. Mm. Just a terrible, terrible moment.
Yeah.
And then producer Don telling us all that he was actually alive.
Yes.
And being kind of, you have that awesome wave of relief. That made me a little bit tearful.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Okay, fine. Well, listen, South Korea advancing, John. It does. It feels like with this tournament, there have been I put a different poll in the chat, and 42% of our audience have cried at a football match.
That's really interesting.
There you go. That's quite nice to know, isn't it?
People should tell us why over the course of the episode, maybe.
Sure.
That'd be fun.
Sure, that would be fun. Now, John, it does feel like there's been an awful lot of, no pun intended, upsets at this tournament. Is that the case, or am I just kind of misremembering how many there would be at a normal World Cup? But if it is the case, what's going on there?
Yeah, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot through the course of the tournament. And it sort of goes back to the conversation that we perennially have about England, which is people think that Gareth Southgate should set the England team up to play much more expansive football, much more exciting football, because he has pieces at his disposal to be able to play in that way. And one of the things that I've noticed is that it seems as though a lot of the teams who are losing in the group stages are teams who are maybe playing in that more expansive way. So part of the argument given is, well, you know, Gareth Southgate is correct because he's setting the team up to get as far as possible, rather than teams like Germany, who, as everyone has been saying, playing quite an aggressive defensive, an aggressive attacking way, which leaves them open for defensive transitions. And I wondered whether or not there's something in this idea that maybe some teams are set up to be, let me get this right, high floor, low ceiling teams, which is teams who are going to be able to face anyone in the group stages and get through by playing fairly conservative football. But then teams who are high ceiling, low floor, teams like Germany, where they are set up to play really well in the knockout stages against some of the elite teams, but they're maybe a little bit more risky in the group stages as well, because they're playing, I guess, more expansive football, which leaves them open to being counted on by teams like Japan or Saudi Arabia in the case of Argentina.
I think you're going to have to ask some questions, because we're being there's an influx, a deluge of stories of people being emotional at football games. So I'm going to go through them and you ask John some questions about what he just said, Seb.
Yeah, I mean, like, the one that really springs to mind, actually, John, is why this tournament? Why have we seen that development now? Because I've noticed it too, and I've sat with you through most of the games, and I completely agree with everything you've said. It's just that it seems like we've made a little bit of a quantum leap from very passive underdog football to where we are now, and that's really strange.
Yeah, we talked about this a bit though, insofar as if you play a low block, what you're doing is you're handing the initiative to the other team, and you're saying, come at us over and over again. We're giving you a high volume of potentially scorable chances, and usually there's a talent mismatch. Like, one of these teams will have a striker who is going to cause you problems from crosses into the box or whatever, or someone who can break down a low block or unlock a low block with technical ability. And I think we've got to a point now where these teams are saying, what's the point of us engaging in that gamble? And so rather than just sitting deep, allowing space in wide areas, for example, we're seeing, I think, these underdog teams pushing higher up the pitch, trying to press teams in their own half to stop them from progressing the ball into the final third. And then we're seeing interesting approaches in terms of those wide areas. So, for example, Saudi Arabia against Argentina, I think they were very smart in that they recognized the different ways that Argentina have been generating chances in qualifying, and they made it hard for Argentina to develop those sorts of attacks from wide areas. And so, yeah, I think what we're seeing then is just probably a talent narrowing, if that makes sense, but also a lot of these players who are playing in leagues around the world at the top level, they're just much more able to implement out of possession structures, because that's what's happening across all of the leagues in well, at the highest level, which allows them then to be able to be more aggressive out of possession, I think.
Do you think part of it is it's a theme we've touched on a little bit during the live streams, but the idea, I've got the South Korea and Portuguese teams in front of me, and what strikes me is that you've got a slightly rotated Portuguese side, but I'm also looking at the players not involved, and there's a sense that like some of the talent pools for these teams, particularly among the favorites, are so deep that there's this sense also that from an underdog's perspective, you just can't wait for a team to punch themselves out. Like, you're not going to get that opportunity because, okay, so for this Portuguese team, you may survive an hour theoretically, but then I don't know, someone like Rafael Leão is going to come on for João Mário on the left side. And that's kind of an intimidating thing. So it, in my mind, if I was a coach, that would encourage me to be a little bit more proactive rather than just kind of wait for my opportunity to occur after an hour and 20 minutes or something.
Yeah, and I think as well in those moments where you are able to transition. I mean, the moment that Korea Republic won the game was a moment where the ball was played to Son, who's a Spurs player.
Yes.
At the very top, and he plays the ball through to Hwang Hee-chan, who's a Wolf. So again, another player who is playing, you know, at the highest level. I think in previous years, Korea Republic wouldn't have been able to enjoy those sorts of players being able to make those sorts of transitions. So I think what we're seeing now is teams with more ability across their squads being able to play better out of possession and then better in possession as well. And I think that it makes for great football, because World Cup, as we've been saying a lot, is, you know, it is a crapshoot. There are going to be situations where, you know, the ball nearly goes out of play but doesn't, and then Japan score, and on the basis of that, Germany are going home and Japan are going through. That's the nature of tournament sport. And I think the narrowing of the gap between the teams that we're calling underdog teams and the teams, the really elite teams, is a good thing for the tournament. But it does pose this question then about how should you approach the tournament as an elite side? Because I think the issue has been with Gareth Southgate, for me anyway, that you get to the latter stages of the tournament and then you don't seem to have the play style to be able to beat the teams that you're coming up against, despite the fact that you've got the squads perhaps to beat them. And that's the thing for someone like Hansi Flick, he's going into the tournament playing the style of play that he thinks is going to beat the teams in the latter stages of the tournament. And it's unfortunately not enough to get him through the group stages, but had they got through, maybe they would have gone deeper than England. And so you have this sort of conundrum of like, how do you approach the group stages as a team who has to maybe modify their approach in the group stages to then the knockout stages?
That feels like a really modern development as well, because like previously 10, 15, 20 years ago, and obviously going back further, it felt like you could arrive in the tournament and you could just be yourself as a team, and the kind of the disparity in individual quality and sort of the power of a squad was so much that it didn't really matter. Because you'd have the passive approach, but also then you just overwhelm the other side. So like that was kind of typical of, I remember the 1998 group that England played in, when they beat Tunisia with quite a ropey performance, lost to Romania, and then beat Colombia. And none of those three performances were particularly good, but it kind of tuned them up through the group. I've got a nerdy question for you, actually, because it's a thing that's come up throughout the tournament. Almost every night we've spoken about transition and different teams and how good they are at transitional football. Now, I recognize a transition, and most other people watching would too. Like you see the kind of the quality of a move build, you see kind of the roles different players are playing within it. How do you coach that? Because like, is that a shadow play situation? Is that a kind of, is that someone on a training ground, literally positioning someone in, you know, one zone and then another and saying, right, when the ball goes here, you're doing this. And when this player has the ball, I want you to make that run up there. I'm pointing kind of northeast for anybody who's listening on the podcast rather than watching on the live stream. How do you become a good transitional football team other than just having a lot of players with pace and technique?
I think that there is logic and reason behind the way that you might approach these sorts of things, but I think they probably come before the stage where you're actually doing the transitioning.
Okay.
So for example, you're a Spurs fan. So yes. Like Spurs are set up to be a transitional team, right?
Yep.
So you get the deep build up, you get the baiting the opposition in to create space. And then you have players like Harry Kane, Son Heung-min and Kulusevski, ideally in your front line, because those three are really good transitional players. I think the best thing you can do in those situations is just breed familiarity between those front three so that they know what the other player is going to do. Because it comes down to these transitions always come down to doing everything in the right order.
Yeah.
And getting everything bang on, right? So that was what happened in the Korea Republic game, is that the ball was played to Son. He got, well, progressed the ball towards the goal, held onto it long enough to evade a challenge, and then saw the run and played it. You just have to get all of those things right in the right order. So I think teams with elite players are going to be great at that, because the elite players are just really good at problem solving. But I think a lot of it will come down to how do we generate these transitional moments? And then when we do generate them, what's the relationship? What's the socio-effective relationship between the players involved in that transition? What's it look like? How's it going to work? And I think that just comes from hours and hours on the training ground.
Joe, would you like back in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, shall we have a quick break? And when we come back, we can carry on chatting.
Yeah.
Okay.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yes, there we go. What a delightful break there. I took some notes from the comments section with a couple of different examples of when people cried or were very emotional at football games. Would you like to hear them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the first one comes from Vince Massara, Australia's qualification for the 2006 World Cup. John Aloisi's winning penalty.
Was that against Uruguay?
Not sure. But Vince says it still gets him now.
Right.
Ali cried when Iraq won the Asia Cup. Biggest underdog story in all football. That's very good. In fact, we have a video
on TIFA Illustrated.
It's one of my favourite videos.
Yes.
This one's slightly different. Omar, I cried during a game of football because I got a concussion and played on. And when we lost, I just started crying. Concussions are weird.
I've had a concussion on a football pitch and it is not a good thing.
What happens to you? What happened to you?
I went up for a header, and the person who was heading the ball, I got to the ball before the person who was challenging for the header with me.
Was the person challenging a wall?
Well, they challenged my temple. So I headed through the ball, moved the ball out of the way, and then he came through the side of my head. I was down on the floor, passed out for a few seconds, and my teammates were quite nervous.
Yeah.
I went off, but then someone had to leave, and they were like, oh, you're standing up, you can come back on. And I just remember wandering around the pitch, being like, I'm not entirely sure why I'm here. Just in general, not just like why I've agreed to come back on. I was just very confused about the state of the world and everything. Yeah.
It's really scary. So I had quite a few concussions. My last one was on the day that David Beckham scored his free kick against Greece at Old Trafford. I was playing as goalkeeper, and I came sliding out on a wet pitch to sweep up after a long ball came through, and the forward chased through and slid in as well. Complete accident, slid in, and one of his, I think, foot, knee, caught me on the temple. And I remember nothing after that. And I remember sitting in the, on the coach, because it was an away game afterwards.
Mm.
And we had the England game on the radio, and Beckham scored and everyone went crazy. I just sat there like this, just completely pale.
Wow.
Also really frightening. I couldn't read for 3 days afterwards. So obviously I was at school. And so
can you read now?
I can read a little bit now. Okay. It's better now.
Yeah. Because
it's been 20 years. And over time, of course, that comes back.
Yeah.
But I remember being in a lesson on the Monday morning, and I was reading, and I could read the words, but that bit where they sort of your brain interprets them and deciphers what they mean just was missing.
3 days later.
It's really frightening.
Wow.
Really
okay, frightening. Well, there we go. We feel Omar.
Don't get concussion.
Be careful.
Basically, yeah. Is the moral of this story.
Gage Wilson, I cried from California in the USA and have been a Liverpool fan my whole life. When I got to Anfield for the first time to see a game, couldn't keep it together, says Gage.
Oh, bless.
Adam, this one's interesting. I had heart arrhythmia that caused a heart attack in 2017 when I was 22. I was watching the Denmark game when Ericsson collapsed. Yeah. Full on lost it. Fair enough. Good Lord. Anyway, thanks so much. I mean, there were so many stories there. I also got a good question while I was in the chat from Jibril. Jibril asks, after the conclusion of the group stages, what are the things that we will miss from these kinds of group stages that have four teams in, given that the next World Cup, is it? Am I right in thinking that it will have three-team groups?
48 teams, three-team groups.
Yeah. So what will we miss about that? I mean, I guess it's, you know, the...
What we've seen tonight and what we saw last night and this kind of idea that...
Someone else pointed out no nine-pointers, by the way. No teams have won every single game.
No, I think we've observed off camera that actually we've been quite lucky with the jeopardy on the final group day. Mm. Also, this idea that on that third game, when the matches are happening simultaneously, the landscape is continually shifting and it's exciting and interesting, and one goal changes everything. And then you see things like the news filter through to the other stadium and players having to react and managers making substitutions on the fly to kind of alter a game again. And today was a really good example of it, because obviously Uruguay felt they had the game won, took off Luis Suarez, and then their situation changed and Suarez was left helpless on the bench watching his international career end.
Also crying. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, before we move on from the emotional talk, I've pinned a comment in the live chat of what I think is the best sports YouTube video. It is by, let me just open it up again so I can get the proper name. It is by Le Breton. I think it's a French channel. It's all clips, all of the best clips put together. It's like 16 minutes long, and it's got that song by M83, the outro. It's such a good video. I watch this video, I would say, once every 6 months and have done for however long. It's, 4 years. Fantastic, fantastic video. Anyway, I've pinned it. Go and watch it after you're done with us. Don't leave now.
No, don't leave now.
As we will see the live stream viewers dwindle. But anyway, fine. Let us discuss then, as you just began to, Uruguay 2, nil Ghana, Seb. Bit of a disappointment for us, because we were hanging out a little bit earlier on with Carl Anker, who was sad for Ghana to lose, of course. And of course, the Ghana coach, Otto Addo, has resigned since.
Yeah, about an hour ago, he has resigned. Still not quite sure as to why or what the justification is there, but he has resigned. Let's say this to begin with, because I felt like this was lost amidst all the talk of 2010 and Suarez and handballs and that kind of thing. Uruguay are a pretty talented side. And I think, realistically, in any game between them, Uruguay would be considered a favourite. So had Ghana won today, that would have been an upset. I felt, and this might be me overemphasizing the narrative, but it felt as if what happened in 2010 was a little bit too prominent today for Ghana. Mm. Don't blame them at all for that, because if that had happened to me or my country, I think I would feel the same way. I don't think you get over something like that, because it's just so cruel. And that's not me attributing blame to Suarez necessarily, it's just what happened. But it was a terrible thing to happen. A terrible kind of footballing trauma to experience. And psychologically, Uruguay were in a very good place with this game. They managed a lot of it very well. I mean, even to the point where Suarez's presence on the pitch was antagonistic. I felt like Suarez did Suarez things. He was at the heart of both goals. The second Uruguayan goal is an absolute picture. It's a beautiful piece of football. It really was. It was tremendous. And converted by a really crisp volley by Arrieta. I think I pronounced that right.
Mm-hmm.
Pronunciation king.
Think so. Yeah.
People's pronunciation king. Mm, yeah.
Thank you.
And
pronunciation hero, I prefer.
Okay, fine. Yeah. You could see Ghana getting more frustrated by what was happening. And you could see every time a Uruguayan player went down, there was agitation. When Ghana won their penalty, which Andre Ayew missed, the Ghanaian players guarded the penalty spot to avoid, to prevent a Uruguayan player from trying to scuff it up and affect the kind of the contact area of the ball, which was a very strange thing to see. I mean, reasonable, because when when one of your country's potentially most sort of defining moments is affected and ruined by a missed penalty, that's the kind of thing that you do. Darwin Nunez got booked trying to scuff up the penalty spot anyway. And I just, it was too, there was too much angst in this game. And I think sort of emotionally, that's quite a, that's a place where Uruguay are comfortable to go. I think these are kind of, I don't know what quite the right word is for this, but there's a, it's just an area which they seem to thrive in. These are talented players. These are players that are capable of winning in multiple different ways. This is a seemingly a very cohesive side full of players that kind of want to fight for each other. It felt like Ghana were playing against Uruguay, but also playing against what happened 12 years ago too. Mm. And that's very sad. I think there was some, John, you don't have any tactical observations. You wouldn't mind if one of the things that kind of, I've done this.
This is my favorite bit of the podcast is when Seb tries to detach the pen from the side of the tactics.
So board. The problem last night was that someone had put the pen in a bit too much, a bit too far, and it was hard to someone. Yeah. And then I moved the board while I was trying to get it out.
That's right, yeah.
John is writing, is doing the JJ thing.
Oh, now John's writing Seb.
I want to talk kind of positively about Ghana because I was really taken by Ahmed Kudus, who... he's shown here in what looks like a number nine or a false nine position. It's really not how he played. He was more just, I mean, he was probably Ghana's most advanced player for much of the game. At the same time, he spent much of it also sort of roaming this central channel. He was almost go as far back as between his own two central midfielders behind Andre Ayew, Jordan Ayew, and Aki Williams too. We don't judge players purely on what they do in a World Cup. I think the reasons for that are fairly well known. We're actually doing a video about it right now. I wrote it this morning.
Yeah.
But what a wonderful footballer.
Yeah.
Just this.
Hard not to get a bit carried away.
Well, mainly because, like, not necessarily because of anything he did today, Joe, although, like, he was really valuable, sort of picking the ball up, sort of 30 yards from the Uruguayan goal, typically beating a player, not Bentancur, because he went off in the first half, and then creating some kind of shooting chance, either for himself or hoping that one of the sort of the wide forwards or Andre Ayew behind was able to kind of provide some support and find a running angle. Bakudis, to me, he's like Moussa Dembélé, the Tottenham midfielder, not the Lyon forward, in the sense that he has this amazing combination of attributes. Like he's very powerfully built, and so he's got a really low center of gravity. He's very strong on the ball, but he's incredibly technically gifted too. And so what you have is this player that has a really... It's quite thick set, difficult to knock off the ball, really good at shielding it from an opponent. So if he was to, for instance, and for podcast listeners, I'm showing him kind of with his back to two midfielders. So he can receive the ball with his back to kind of to opponents, spin away from them, but with an element of disguise, which you typically don't associate with players who have his body shape. And honestly, like I know he's played, he's kind of led the line for Ghana. He spent a lot of his season playing as a number nine for Ajax too. Not necessarily that successfully. I think you could play him, and this is really the root of his value, you could play him as a kind of modern number 10, which is really a sort of an eight, really. Mm-hmm. You could play him as a six because he looks awfully comfortable receiving the ball off his defenders. He's so gifted. Like I can't believe that when January comes around that Everton are going to be his only option again.
I'm sure.
Good move for him, I'm sure, but like there'll be
other
clubs. This
is a fun topic of conversation though, isn't it? Because
are you having fun?
Yeah.
Join in.
I was going to say, who is going to be moved on in the January transfer window off the back of the World Cup? Because it feels like there's going to be...
So if Kudus is on the list, who else is on your list, John?
Oh, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about
it. So what John thinks about it, like I went to Bayer Leverkusen a couple of weeks before the World Cup and I had a chance to speak to Simon Rolfs, who is the director for sport. He's kind of like, that's a sort of Leverkusen's version of sporting director. And we asked him whether...
Very, very sort of quirky, isn't it? How they've switched that around.
Well, it's because
director for sport.
He took Rudy Foller's job there, and the idea was to kind of replicate the position that he had.
I'm laughing mainly because of the number of different job title types there are.
Sporting director,
all these different clubs.
Technical director,
it's kind of the same thing.
Managing director of football. Sure. Right. So he said, when we asked him about the World Cup, he said, we're not sending a single scout there because clubs don't use the World Cup as a kind of talent evaluation for him anymore. Like it's just another game that they log into a database. It might be like, you might take a little detail about something like player does well in high pressure situations potentially. Yeah. But the idea of going and be like, oh, he's good. What's his name? Mohamed Kudus. I might sign him. That era is over.
The scouts are gutted, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because the scouts
free trip to the World
have been dining out on World Cup restaurants for years on the work credit card, say John McKenzie. We all know this, the scouts. They've been out there, haven't they? In the cafes, having, hot drinks on the company dime, you know what I'm saying? And just having a great time at the World Cup. Yeah. Your comeuppance is here, scouts. I don't feel untowards the scouts, just to be clear. I was just
I've got a name for John, by the way.
Just trying to do a bit there.
In terms of kind of players who might move as a result of the World Cup. Mm-hmm. Sofyan Amrabat.
Ah, yes.
He playing in Serie A.
Yeah, plays for Fiorentina.
Now, I know that name.
Yes.
Why do I know that name?
Because he's been very, very good at the base of Morocco's midfield.
I knew he was at the base of a midfield, but I couldn't remember whose.
Yeah. Mm. So he's... he's someone I think who, like, I don't think Morocco work without Amrabat at the moment. I think he's kind of the key to a lot of things. And I think that might, although no one would ever admit it, that might be an example of someone going to a World Cup, playing in a slightly better team than his club side is, and people seeing a little bit more of him in the kind of like, oh, there's a range to him. He's a slightly better player than we thought he is. I think his reputation is soared during the World Cup. Mm. Whether that's the right thing to believe and whether like someone spends £30 million and actually it's all nonsense. Maybe that I'm sure that's a kind of caveat there. But no doubt that like people will look at him and think, actually, you know, in the search for a player of that mold, someone that secures your midfield and someone that provides security for more technically able players to go and play.
Yeah, for sure.
That kind of player is always in demand, right?
I've got one as well. Maybe if you're still having to think about who might be on your list, John. I've watched this player mostly for the first time. Think they're really under the radar. Think they're really exciting and under the radar. Mbappe, it's Mbappe. I think Mbappe should be signed by someone. I think he's good.
I think Mason Mount should be signed by someone. Yeah.
Should we talk about that?
I mean, you can if you want.
I mean, your Twitter notifications and then subsequently mine out of solidarity were already burned all day. But I'll tell people who are listening who who wouldn't be aware of that, who don't just stalk us all day. We made a video that went out this morning on the Tifo Illustrated channel, and it's called "What Does Mason Mount Actually Do?" Now, I think that's a very interesting question, because Mason Mount is one of those sort of illusory players who is clearly talented. I thought that was a given. Apparently not. Clearly talented, but it's not quite clear what role is his. You know, he's like he almost reminds me of a kind of like high level version of a player who's 17 and whose final position is yet to be completely defined. So in my mind, it's not clear that they play here or there or whatever. And John, you wrote the script for this video, talked about all the things he's good at, and prominently you talked about why the managers that he plays for repeatedly pick him over other players and what those reasons for that might be. Anyway, the video goes out, you do a tweet about it, and then...
I didn't even do a tweet about it. It came out from our Tifo account.
The Tifo account did one, yeah.
I noticed this morning, I was like, good Lord, there's a lot of people who really don't like Mason Mount. It turns out there's a whole controversy, not from us, but that already pre-existed, about people saying, it's Mason Mount's PR on the case again, or like, here's the journalists on the take or something. I mean... what possible motivation could that be for saying Mason Mount is good? It's so stupid.
It's kind of like...
It's so stupid. God, Lord, honestly, it's fine. It doesn't matter. It's not a big deal. But honestly, like... Well, there are like 300 replies.
This is what broke you. Like, this is 13 days in. We've been not getting a lot of sleep.
I'm not broken, I honestly think it's so funny to me that like... that this is something that there would be such a weird toxic community for. It's like it must have its own subreddit or something. I expect these people are going to the same Christmas parties.
We're now on the subreddit.
We're on the subreddit. Yeah, the prime victims of the subreddit. Anyway, I think it's weird. Mason Mount's clearly a good footballer. What he actually does best on the pitch is up for debate for sure. And if Chelsea fans don't, you know, some Chelsea fans don't like him, that's obviously their own prerogative. But I've never known there to be such vitriol.
I don't understand the anger. Like, liking him,
I don't
get
it either.
Well, not liking a player is absolutely fine. I just don't understand why it's such an angry issue.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. Mm. But I'm not a Chelsea fan, so.
Should we get back to happier things?
Sure. Yeah.
So... yeah. Just a few players coming to the top of my head. There's been some good ones in the chat, actually. The chat very knowledgeable. But Cody Gakpo, obviously.
Cody Gakpo.
Is the one that... Sure. He's coming to the end of his contract, so we'll be moving on, I think.
What is he, 24 years old? Something like that?
Yeah. 23, 24, something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we have to say Harry Suter because, you know, the Australian people hate me enough as it is, so yeah, we'll throw him on there. But he's had an excellent tournament and is at Stoke City, so he's a very movable, honourable.
Mitch Duke, too. If you're going to talk about the Australian guys, I think he's been good.
Josko Gvardiol, I think he sort of became prominent in the last tournament, but he definitely had a good tournament and will be moving somewhere at some point, I think.
Gvardiol, absolutely.
Ritsu Doan for...
The Japanese player? Oh, I love that guy.
At Freiburg. So Freiburg are a team who move players on quite readily anyway.
Yeah.
So I suspect...
Doesn't that mean... We talked about him a lot last night and I thought of you because you support Freiburg.
Who's been absolutely excellent for Freiburg.
You wouldn't want him to leave, presumably.
No, but what Freiburg do so well is they make you fall in love with players and move them on and then bring someone else who you fall in love with as well. So yeah, last season I was in love with Nico Schlotterbeck. Now I'm in love with Ritsu Doan, amongst others as well. So Hincapier as well, Piero Hincapier at Leverkusen. Really good ball playing centre-back. I think he will be moved on. And there have been rumours about Gusong Cho. Tyler Adams, yeah.
Musa, sure, in the American midfield too, the Valencia player. I've really liked him. Mm. I think he's been good.
Mm. Yeah, so plenty of potential movers and shakers in January.
I'm just going to say one more thing about Mason Mount. Yeah, this is it.
I tried to move you on, but you're...
This is the last thing I'll say about Mason Mount, okay? I'm not a football expert. I don't, you know, but all of the Chelsea managers are, yeah? They all are. And the England manager is, yeah? And they repeatedly pick that player to play in their team. I mean, what more evidence do you need that that is a good football player? Don't take my word for it. Huh?
It's a funny thing because Mason Mount has been a kind of wunderkind from as long as anybody can remember. For as long as anybody
moves
can remember.
Moves to Germany for what? Six
that's,
months.
That's wunderkid for the people who aren't fluent in German in the chat.
So when Mason Mount was playing age group football for the England team, he was, this is the feat, people expected him to be the future of the England senior side. And so there's always been this perception that like he's just been promoted and promoted and promoted. I don't understand why he's so objectionable. There are England games where I think he should play and where I don't think he should, but
sure.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he's the best player in the world. Do you know what? Everything I've said is a tweet I would have deleted as a draft. That's what this is.
Because it's not really worth the...
It's not really worth the engaging. No. Everything I've said about it, I would have written it out and then gone,
I wonder how high up the list of like central midfielders who can attack a bit Mason Mount actually is, though. Because when you think about it like that, there's not a lot of them at that level.
Sure.
So he's feasibly in like the top 50 midfielders in the world. That's mad, isn't it? And yet people think he's awful.
Yeah. Should we go for a really expensive dinner later? Now we've said that.
Now we've earned our cash. Yeah.
Not an under the radar suggestion, but I'm
Mbappe.
Almost. I'm amazed by how good Luka Modric still is.
Yeah.
Like I was saying to JJ yesterday, we were watching. There are times when I watch him play at the moment. I think, is he better?
Here's a question for you.
Than he used to be.
Could a team buy Luka Modric for 2 years? What do you think? 2 year contract, Luka Modric?
Which team?
I don't know. Any team. Big team?
There's not many that he wouldn't improve. Like he's
Arsenal.
Yeah.
I quite like that. Now I've said it out loud. What do you think?
Yeah, of course. Like
Luka Modric to Arsenal?
I object to it as a Spurs fan.
Sure.
Yeah, but like, I mean, there aren't many places that he couldn't go and start. I think it's probably fair
to
say.
It's mad to think Modric was at Spurs, isn't it? It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. What time are we on, producers? We're on 40. Okay, let's have another break. And when we come back, we will talk about a bit more football. Yes, okay. Switzerland 3-2 Serbia. This was a very exciting game. What happened in this one, John?
I'm just trying to find it on the board.
Oh, well, what happened in this one, Seb?
Well, really good first half. 2-2 at half time. A lot of tension in it. There's a lot of ill feeling, which goes back to 2018 and the kind of the animus between some of the Serbian players or most Serbian players and Jedon Čikiri and Granit Xhaka. But it didn't really boil over until probably about an hour in, John, I would say. And for most part, there's some really good football played. Mm-hmm. Lots of different things to admire, which I think John will speak about in more depth. I know he's kind of interested in the selection of Mitrovic and Vlahovic up front.
I'm not sure I've ever seen John as satisfied as when really Mitrovic scored. You just kept saying over and over again, that's a really, really good goal. Yeah, yeah. That's a perfect goal.
He really liked
I've never seen a goal like that. I love that goal.
It's not that I've never seen a goal like that before, but it's that everything that happened was what you thought is going to happen before it happened, and then it happened.
Yeah, 100%.
That's what it was.
It
was
like resolved itself.
It was
perfectly.
Like the passes went in the right area, the cross went in the right area, the run was in the right, and Mitrovic didn't even have to change his run. He just glanced the header into, and it was just everything about it was perfect.
Really lovely finish.
Yeah, and it was a really fun game in terms of what was going on tactically. So I talked a little bit at the beginning of the tournament about why Serbia are quite fun, because they're one of the few teams who are playing two out and out nines.
Yes,
and then they promptly didn't do that in any of the games apart from this one. So we finally had Vlahovic starting alongside Mitrovic, and we talked about it in the previous game, because what happened, if you look on the board, in previous games is that Tadic had played alongside Mitrovic, so Vlahovic hadn't played, and then Milinkovic-Savic played as the 10 behind them, or the more attacking midfielder of the three. And it just basically threw everything slightly off. Everyone was sort of pushed up one, whereas when Vlahovic was available, then everyone just sort of moved back into their better positions, essentially, and made this work a little bit better. Great fun just watching two out and out nines, because we spent half of this tournament talking about how there's no nines, like proper nines, whatever that means. And then we got a game with two absolutely top level elite number nines playing, and they both scored in their own different ways. So Mitrovic with the header, and then Vlahovic doing that sort of finish that he has in his toolbox, which is looks like he's not going to score, gets somehow contact on it, and then it seems to dribble into the bottom corner somehow, running through the middle. So yeah, it was great for fans of number nines in that respect.
Let me add a third number nine, because I thought Brill Mbolo was absolutely brilliant. Mbolo is someone who for a long time was expected to be a real force in European football. If you go back to his time at Basel, when he signed for Schalke, people thought that's what a brilliant deal, because he was actually rumoured to go to Manchester United at the time, like everyone is every single summer, admittedly. But he suffered some terrible injuries. He had a fractured ankle and or lower leg in his first season at Schalke. It took him years to regain his fitness, but also at the same time, Schalke was a disaster zone for quite a few years before their relegation from the Bundesliga. And this is the first tournament, I think, because this wasn't really the case in the European Championship 18 months ago, where Mbolo looks healthy and you can see the full range of his abilities. Now, you know how after a game people put YouTube compilations together of John McKenzie touches and skills against Manchester United. Do you find one of them, Mbolo? Watch it. That everything he does is so selfless and so kind of, he works so hard, and it's all of his contributions are laced with a perfect understanding of how to protect the ball, but also for where his teammates are too. And you see it's a perfect example of a lone forward working really, really hard for his team, but then also at critical moments, having the class to sort of, for the second goal, make the run to the back post, but for the third goal, make the run, which sets up the goal, which I think Remo Freeler eventually scores at the back post. It's a beautiful goal, that. It's probably one of my favorites of the group stage, but he was just superb. And I think it's a nice story, because he's still only, I think it's 24 or 25, but one of the two. He's still in his mid-20s.
He's 24 until he's 25.
He certainly is. That is definitely, definitely true. Even though it feels like he's been around forever. So it's really nice to see maybe the beginning of a second act. He's at Monaco now, and it seems to be going relatively well for him, but just a great performance. And it's sort of, when a player, there's a lot of hype around a player when he's a teenager and people kind of dismiss him, and then eventually he comes back and everyone's like, actually, he is a player and he's kind of having his moment in a really important game. Because this is it's not the most high profile game, but this is a very, very big game for all sorts of different reasons, footballing and political. And he was certainly among the Swiss match winners.
I wanted to talk a little bit about just the way that Switzerland were trying to cause problems for Serbia, actually, because Serbia are playing in a 3-5-2 formation, as we've said, and they've got wing backs here and here. So the big challenge is always going to be in these sorts of games, like how do we exploit these areas in behind the wing backs and with the narrow back three. And I think that that Switzerland did some really nice things to do that. Obviously, Mbolo was part of that. But what was fascinating about what they were doing is that they were often building through the middle in order to sort of draw the three centre-backs in, again, just making more space in these sorts of areas. They also had their fullbacks pretty conservative, so they're not getting that high up the pitch. So that means that essentially you're pinning the fullbacks a little bit as well. So you're, again, generating more space in these sorts of areas. But yeah, Mbolo, I didn't mean to do that. Mbolo, really, really good at dropping in to help out, picking the ball up and then allowing the ball to be feathered through into these sorts of areas. So we saw Shaqiri...
Into the wide areas,
on either side. We saw Shaqiri score in the first half from one of those moments. And actually the second goal for Switzerland came from, actually, I think it was Widmer getting into this kind of area where the Swiss build-up through the middle has pulled everything quite tight, generated space to run into in behind the fullback, and then Widmer gets the ball in, and then Mbolo's doing that other thing that you want your centre-forward to do, which is getting in behind the line of the defence as well and finishing at the back post. So really, really smart ways of developing space in those wide areas, which is what you want to do against a 3-5-2. And yeah, they very much deserved to go through on the basis of this game, I think.
Okay. Brazil 0-1 Cameroon, Seb. That was the other game. We didn't pay a huge amount of attention to it because Brazil were already through, but Cameroon won.
Yeah, and it's absolutely so. Vincent Aboubakar is box office. Just a brilliant, brilliant header to win the game. One of those where his weight is kind of distributed in the wrong way and it kind of suited really more to a flicked header, and yet gets I suppose enough neck on it to actually redirect it in back across goal and score. He then takes his shirt off to celebrate, gets a second yellow card and gets sent off. And it's just like, that's it.
I mean, why not? I guess if you know you're going out of the tournament.
Blaze of glory, right? Blaze that's glory. It. You know, absolutely. Cameroon, I have to say, like, Cameroon better than I expect them to be. Mm. Just unlucky that kind of the results didn't really drop for them.
Yeah.
But Aboubakar he's an interesting guy. Like, it was fun listening to Carl the other night talk about him and kind of some of the controversies he's got involved with around AFCON and Mohamed Salah and that kind of stuff. But we kind of made the choice to both watch the Serbia-Switzerland game because we thought that's where the group would be decided. And we have to kind of make those difficult choices in, you know, when the games are simultaneous. Yeah. So we focused on the other one.
Yeah, Brazil seemed to change up their entire team, though, just looking at the starting lineup again, I guess. They are of the opinion, as we discussed a couple of days ago, that it's better to rest players when you're already through than it is to keep that team momentum playing together, John.
Yeah, I mean, I still don't necessarily get why you would do that other than to make the whole squad feel as though they're involved. Mm. Personally, over such a small sample size of games as a coach, I think I would probably want to work on things that I've picked up in the first two games and try and iron those problems out. But again, maybe it's just a case of what we were talking about before, which is you might not be playing a particularly representative game. Like the game that Cameroon are playing against Brazil isn't going to be one that they're going to expect to play after the round of 16. Mm-hmm. And so maybe there's not really that much benefit in it anyway. But as we were talking about before, when we were talking about transitions, like one of the benefits that you get from having more games together is that your attacking units, for example, will know where their teammates are going to move and how they think and stuff. Because a lot of these guys won't be playing together that often, regardless of the fact that you're playing, you know, qualifying games all the way through the year. It's I just always think in these situations, it's better to get the experience than it is to get the rest. But that's based on nothing other than my gut feeling. So clearly other coaches don't feel that way. So
I think I'm right in saying that actually there was Edison made a really, really good save in this game. And it was actually from... you know, at the time, the first shot that Brazil had faced on target during the whole competition, which is quite interesting. The only thing I'd say, like, I agree almost entirely with John. I just think that there is virtue in starting someone like a Martinelli, who nearly scored with a really good header. A pass he made a fabulous save to deny him. Like, to get a few minutes and, like, Martinelli's selection was a little bit controversial back in Brazil. Some people didn't like it at all. They didn't think he'd earned it. It's a special circumstance, admittedly, but if he was to score, then maybe you have your kind of equilibrium back and you quiet some of the kind of conversation around your score place. Mm. But other than that, yeah, I agree. It's like, you know, a bit of chemistry never hurt anybody, really.
Okay, well, there we go. Now, we have all of the round of 16 games lined up. Netherlands play the United States. This is on the Group A, C, E, G bracket. I looked at the bracket for the first time last night so I can see who's going to face who potentially. On one side, we've got Netherlands against the United States, Argentina, Australia, Japan, Croatia, and now we have Brazil, South Korea. I think that is definitely the easier side of the bracket, because on the other side, there's England, Senegal, France, Poland, Morocco, Spain, and Portugal, Switzerland. Portugal, Switzerland is going to be a stodgy game, isn't it?
Yeah, that looks like it's going to be one of the stodgiest games of that group, I think.
Yeah. But
it's a really interesting mix of teams, isn't it, across the tournament.
And yeah. It also means that on the one hand, we are most likely to have, let's say, for example, we do have the favourites that are expected to get all the way through to the final. We're most likely to have an all-European semi-final on one side and an all-South American semi-final on the other. Brazil, Argentina on the left. And, I mean, of England, France, Spain, Portugal potentially. Of course, you know, wouldn't be surprised, having seen how well Morocco have played, for example, that they go fairly far.
Yeah, I agree. I want Brazil, Argentina. I feel like I've earned that.
In the semi-final?
Yeah.
Brazil, Argentina, World Cup semi-final.
I want that.
That's pretty cool.
I have to have that now, because we work quite hard.
I have to have that now. Yeah. There's Seb's demanding side coming out. Okay, well, that's fairly exciting, isn't it? Cool. We are going to talk about FIFA rankings and how the system works. Before we do that, can I ask the production gang, are we able to play the Ban Summers version of Points Are Bad a bit later? Is that already lined up? Yeah, that is perfect. Do you know what? I feel like that one today.
Yeah,
that was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was. Yeah.
Now, John, let's discuss FIFA rankings. Yeah?
My favorite.
We had this conversation because Belgium, who are bad and out, or were bad during the tournament and out, are technically ranked second in the world in the FIFA ranking system. And that seems a bit nuts to me. So I was curious to know how the ranking system actually works, why it's the case that Belgium are second when there are clearly better teams.
I've got the FIFA men's rankings on the board in front of me. So Brazil are top and then Belgium are second and have been first or second, I think, since 2018. So they've been there or thereabouts for quite a while now.
Who else have we got on the list?
We've got Argentina, then France, then England, then Italy, then Spain, then Netherlands, Portugal, and Denmark.
Right.
And this is correct as of October the 6th, it's worth saying at this point. Obviously, there's been a lot of games played in between that time frame, so there will be change afoot. But yeah, the big question is, well, how have Belgium still there? And I think to answer this question, we need to have a certain amount of context given. So in 2018, the FIFA world rankings, which have been running since 1992 in various guises, they decided that they needed to change the way that they were doing things. Now, before that point, what had been happening was a simple point system. So there was an algorithm that worked out how many points you would get for beating a team, and you got that number of points. And what would happen is that it would average out over a 4-year period. And that would be the ranking system that you would get. But there was a problem with this. And that problem was that, well, I think I've got it on this next slide. So this is a slide from FIFA's own PDF explaining the new system that was brought in 2018.
Yeah.
As you can see here, they've said they're adjusting the game weightings to give less importance to friendly matches, because what was happening is that because of the algorithm that was used to apportion points before 2018, if you played in an international friendly, it gave you fewer points than you would do if you were playing a competitive match.
Right.
And because your ranking was then based on an average of points across 4 years, if you were playing friendly matches, your ranking points would go down. And so what we saw...
So teams don't all play the same number of friendlies, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And there were some teams who recognized this. They read the small print and they realized that actually it's better for us to not play friendlies.
Nerd teams reading the small print. Yeah. Come on, that's like major nerd teams.
It is quite nerdy. But so for example, Wales and Romania, I think, went through periods of just not playing any friendly games because it bumped their ranking points up. And it meant that then when they were being put into pots for... tournament selection, they would get in a higher pot. So obviously there was an issue here, so things had to change. So in 2018, FIFA brought in this new system, which is called SUM.
That's very catchy.
What they did was they moved from that point system that I've talked about already, where you're averaging points out over a 4-year period, to an ELO rating system. You know what an ELO rating system is, Joe, don't you?
I sort of do, because you say it to me when we play video games a lot. and I go, yes, John, that's absolutely, yes. The ELO, yes, that's right. What is it? What is that?
Yeah, Arpad Elo was a Hungarian dude who wanted to work out basically a scoring system that would work for chess.
Elo was a guy?
There you go.
Smart, isn't he?
Learning so much. Yeah, okay, come on.
And the idea was that you want a system which is going to mean that if you play a game against someone else who has a point a set of points and you play against them, and there'll be an algorithm to work out how many points that you will lose if you lose to them, or how many points you'll win if you win against them. So it's a scarce system, because everyone has a set number of points and they get passed backwards and forwards between different
people. Finite number.
That's right, yeah. So the idea then is that what happens is as teams play one another, they should eventually over time end up in a sort of ranking that, shows you what's going on.
Do you think if you ever had a baby, you might call it Elo?
Probably not, to be honest.
No. Okay.
But yeah, so at the bottom of this screen in front of me, we've got the algorithm for working out how many points are going to be lost when two teams, or one, depending on who loses or wins. And it looks very complicated, but basically it's your ranking points basically are the points that you have before you play, plus I, which is the importance of the game that you're playing. So again, you are still getting weighted towards whether or not you're playing a friendly game versus like a competitive game. And then here you've got the result. So if you win, lose or draw, and then it can be penalty shootouts as well, which changes things as well. And then the other thing is the expected win thing here. So really simple algorithm that works out how many points you lose or gain.
Based on whether you're expected to win or not. So that's why, for example, if I play and dominate a silver ranked player in Rocket League, I get very few points.
Exactly.
Because I should be beating the silver.
So in this part of the equation, there's actually... it takes into account the rating levels of both teams involved. So if you lose or win against a team that's quite close to you in the ranking system, then it won't be a huge points change.
Right.
Whereas if you play someone who's a lot lower than you in the system, then it will result in a bigger points change.
Yeah, okay.
And so the big question, I suppose, is why are Belgium second? And the reason for that is they've just not really lost very often since 2018. So they played 62 games since they lost in the semi-finals?
Yeah, they lost in the 2018 World Cup.
But they played 62 games.
They played 62 games
in 4 years.
In 4 years.
That's way more than I would have thought.
God, there's a lot of international football.
That's loads.
Do you want to guess how many they've lost? Well, you can see it's on the board.
How many have they lost?
So until the World Cup started, they'd lost 7 games, I think.
Of those 62?
Yeah.
That's not many.
Not many at all. And it's worth saying. So we've got a list here as well. There's a couple of things to note. Firstly, the teams that they're losing to are really highly ranked, pretty much. So there was a loss to Switzerland. That was the first loss that they had after the World Cup. Switzerland are currently ranked 15th. I suspect back then they may have been even ranked in the top 10.
Yeah.
Didn't check that out. But
I think they were.
Since then, all of the losses that they've had until we got to the World Cup warm-up stage just before this World Cup, so a month ago, they lost in a World Cup warm-up to Egypt, and then they lost to Morocco in the World Cup as well. But before that, everyone was inside the top 10 pretty much. And as I said before, when you're using an ELO system, if you're losing to teams who are close to you, you don't see much of a points change. The other thing to notice is that a lot of these teams, they're losing one game in the Nations League, but then winning the other fixture. So they're basically swapping points backwards and forwards as well.
So Belgium will forever be second.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow. Seems like the system doesn't work. Is that a fair criticism or am I misunderstanding?
It just feels like it's an imperfect system. That's all. Like it's kind of, it was also, I think it's worth remembering that FIFA rankings are ceremonial, right? They don't qualify you for anything. Like if you finish in the top whatever of the tennis rankings at the end of the year, you go and play in that tournament in the O2 arena. It's not the same in football. You don't sort of get easier access to the World Cup, for instance, or, you know, so I don't have a problem with it. It just, in my mind, it's always the thing where when I was younger, the FIFA rankings would be released and England would be somewhere and everyone would be upset about it for one reason or another.
Yeah.
And that's what I associate with my mind. And also, since John started saying ELO, I've just been hearing Electric Light Orchestra songs in my head and not really thinking. I've kind of glazed over a little bit.
Fair enough.
He has brought me down.
It's worth saying as well, just quickly, that if we look at the actual points tables as it stands, there's about 40 points between Argentina in third place and Belgium in second. And I worked out how many points that Belgium probably will lose by losing in the group stages of a World Cup to Morocco.
Yes.
And it works out about 13 points. So they will take negative 13 points from that result, which is not enough for them to drop down even to the next level on the chart. So I guess the big problem seems to be that because when they brought in the ELO ranking system, they just ported across everyone from the old system onto the new system. And it seems legitimately hard for you to really drop in any big way out of that, out of the position that you're in. Most of these teams are in similar positions. I think there's a couple of teams, Croatia and Uruguay, have dropped out, but largely...
Really? That's interesting.
And okay. even then, they've just dropped into the top 20. So you have to pan quite hard, I think, to really change your position in the ranking.
You know, the one that actually surprises me is France. Like, on the basis that they have performed extremely well over the last sort of, since 2018, obviously winning the World Cup, but getting to, they got knocked out by Switzerland, I suppose, which damages them. But like, on the basis that they have performed significantly better in terms of actual trophy hardware than Belgium, Brazil, or Argentina, and yet still, actually, the difference between them is quite substantial still.
I think this is, again, comes back to what we showed before, which was that Belgium haven't really lost to any low-ranked teams that often. Because France have lost to, I think, Luxembourg in maybe a qualifying game at some point, or a Nations League game. And those are the results which really hammer your points system, because there's such a big gap between the two teams. So.
Has that happened to Germany? Because they're not in the top 10.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, they've had consecutive World Cup eliminations in the group stage. They've lost to, as John's explained, the effect of losing to a lower ranked team is actually quite significant.
Sure.
Also, they have, not in the recent round of games, but they suffered a Nations League elimination, relegation. They've also had...
Didn't England?
Yeah, England most recently, but sort of in the Nations League campaign in which... England got to the finals in Portugal.
In that one,
Germany ended up getting relegated from their group, and they came back. And you know,
well, it's quite interesting to look at this and think about as it applies to the current World Cup. Of course, Belgium, the highest team up there, already out of the tournament. Italy in sixth place, not in the tournament. Denmark in 10th, going out as well. Everybody else through.
The chat is telling me that actually seedings are based on rankings. So apologies, chat. You're quite right. Of course.
Okay. Well, thanks, John.
You're welcome.
Shall we play Points Are Bad now?
I'd like to play Points Are Bad.
Should we all put our headphones on and then cue Craig so we can listen to a nice song?
Go on then, Craig.
Yeah, we're going to listen now to Ban Summer's version of Points Are Bad, which is a lovely version. I listened to it last night. It's a lovely version. It's much better than the original.
You've really taken to it. Yeah.
Hit it, Craig.
Points Are Bad.
There we go. Thanks again to Ban Summers.
A Lumineers vibe to that. You know,
don't bring us down, sir. Now listen, Points Are Bad time. Oof. I'm a pretty happy guy, John. I'm a pretty happy guy, but we'll come to that later. You'll know why. Now, of course, tomorrow, there's only two games. So we only have to make two predictions, which is easier than it was before, which of course means today is the end of the group stages. Now, some of us did okay today. Some of us did less well. I can tell you that on match day 13, with the games Ghana, Uruguay, Korea, Republic, Portugal, Serbia, Switzerland, Cameroon, Brazil, we have another big loser in JJ Bull. He gained 12 points today. We've really put him under pressure last night to make quick predictions.
He's buckled.
Yeah. He's buckled big time. Yeah. He's at home today, so he's had more time to make his predictions, I think maybe he'll do a bit better tomorrow.
But I think once you get on that wagon of panicking, then you start getting onto the, oh, now I need to do the equal and opposite panic.
That's the case. Listen, he's picked up 24 points in the last 2 days. Another 12 today. That is almost a quarter of what we all have, and we've been playing for 13 days. So he's had a real stinker. There's no other way of putting it. 12 points gained. John, you've also had quite a bad day. You gained 10 points today.
That's mad, because I was only on 2 points after the first two games.
Yes, you were. I've had a pretty good day. I'm on 7 points added. I only added one for each of the evening games, because I predicted a 2-2 in Serbia-Switzerland and 1-1 in Cameroon-Brazil. So just one off in each of those. But we have a winner today. Seb Stafford-Bloor, you've only added 6 points today. And that perfect score in Korea Republic Portugal of 2-1 for Korea Republic, that has earned you a win today. Very impressive. Well done. Little clap there for Seb Stafford-Bloor. It's your second win. Second group day win. Fine. Now, that means, Seb, you go last, of course. It means that John goes second. But it means, of course, that we first hear from JJ Ball for his predictions. And for his predictions, Netherlands-USA is the first game tomorrow. JJ's prediction, is 2-1 to the USA.
He's losing it, isn't he?
I have a question.
He's in his own head.
What's your question?
I cannot remember what we did regarding like extra time and penalties last time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
I think we should have talked about this earlier, but I think let's just do scores.
Do you know what we did? I remember exactly what we did. We did this, but this won't be in the brilliant spreadsheet that's been worked out for us. So what it is we ignore penalties altogether.
Yeah.
We just ignore them.
Yeah.
If it goes to penalties, it goes to penalties. This is a purely stupid game based on scores.
If you want penalties, you have to go for a draw.
No. This is the thing. What we did last time was we said you could say 2-1 and you could say penalties.
Oh, right? That's it.
Was penalties, it would be minus another point for you. Even if you said 2-1 and that wasn't it, you know, that your predictions didn't have to be. But the issue is that the nice chap who built this spreadsheet has not built that into it. And also, it's a stupid
rule. To keep it simple.
So you just get to guess each game whether or not it goes to penalties or not.
Scores only. We're just guessing how many goals each team gets. We're not guessing what the result of the game is.
Embrace the silliness.
Embrace the silliness, John. Yeah, forget about it. It's fine. I predicted 2-2 today. Doesn't matter if there was penalties. Yeah? But we do take final results after extra time.
Okay.
Not at full time. So if you predict 2-2 and it's 2-2.
That can't possibly happen.
It can. If it finishes in penalties, it's a 2-2.
Okay.
So nobody's going to predict any draws now, are they? Unless that's the best possible way of... We are live.
Yes, let's just carry on.
Fine. Let's carry on. We'll think about it afterwards. Fine.
And hope there's no penalties.
There's no penalties. John, you are second to pick for Netherlands, USA, please.
I will go 2-0 Netherlands.
2-0 Netherlands. Fine. It's me to go next. I happen to think JJ's might be onto something here, but I'm afraid.
Doesn't work like that. If there's two options, it can be.
I'm going to say 1-1.
Okay.
And I'm
penalties?
It doesn't matter about penalties. It doesn't matter. Seps up a ball, you say.
So I've heard that the Dutch squad has been ravaged by flu. So I'm going to say 1-0 USA.
He waited till the end before he told us that, didn't he?
Yeah. We published it on The Athletic.
Well, I don't have time to read that. I'm busy. So look, it's a fantastic product, but I am busy. Yeah? Working here, making stuff for it.
Hey, you're making something pretty cool at the moment, which is coming out very soon.
Making something very cool.
Very cool.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Not as cool as The Athletic, but it's pretty cool. Argentina, Australia. Now let's hear from JJ. JJ wants a 2-0 for Argentina. I think that's probably going to be a fairly popular idea there, John. Argentina, yes. Australia.
2-0 sounds good. I'd probably go for that myself if I could, but I can't.
You can.
So I will go for... I'm going to go 3-0.
You're going to go 3-0. Yes. Okay.
For my sins.
I was thinking about saying Australia. I think that's stupid. That's a mistake. Is that a mistake? Oh, I just feel they've got the weight of a nation behind them. You know, you're egging me on.
Seb has to vote for them. That's true. Seb doesn't vote for them. He'll lose his status.
He'll lose his honorary Australian status. Yeah. What about all the towns that put the image of you up?
Yeah.
You know, they'll burn it.
Yeah.
They will. Yeah. Okay, fine.
Mount Stafford burn.
I'm going to say 1-0. I think it's going to be a stodge fest.
That's a good shout, to be honest.
What do you think, Seb?
Goalless draw.
That's a terrible prediction. Because think about it this way, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody has to score or it's going to go to penalty. You think it's going to go 120 minutes with no goals?
I do. Yeah.
You say that so confidently.
No, I. It's what I want to happen.
He's heard that both camps have been ravaged by the flu.
A goalless draw.
It's like an episode of the Oregon Trail. Isn't it? Both camps have been ravaged by the flu. Goalless draw.
I think goalless draw is a worry now, because before a goalless draw was a goalless draw for 90 minutes. Now it's a goalless draw for 120 minutes with some tired players out there. That's not. I think draws are out of balance. I know I said 1-1 before, but that's just because I'm going for scores.
My hair's got like a remarkably JJ quality to it all of a sudden.
Yeah, yeah.
What about now? Is it better now?
He's been wearing the headphones all day. That's why it gets all, you know.
He's got headphone hair.
Someone said my hair was flat the other day.
Like your personality.
Like, right, fine. Okay, there we go. Those are our predictions for the games tomorrow. Only two games, of course. We'll be able to concentrate on all of them. Imagine that. That'll be nice, wouldn't it? Fine. And I can tell you that the reason I'm so happy is because...
Are you no longer lost?
Jonathan McKenzie.
I am no longer lost.
Oh,
no!
I end the group stages as the people's hero. I end the group stages in third place.
Must be pretty close, though. Points.
It's very close. You are breathing down the neck of the people's hero. The goblin's hero is chasing close behind on 110 points.
So 1 point behind you.
1 point behind. 1 point. Hmm? And of course, I am now 7 points behind Seb Stafford-Blore.
In first place.
Who is our new leader at the end of the group stages. JJ has totally ruined it.
That makes me so happy.
104 points.
That makes
JJ
me so happy.
So there is only 8 points between first and last in this game. It's all to play for. It's never been all to play for at the end of the group stages before. JJ, thrown it away like an idiot man has thrown it away. A fool, Seb.
I can't believe it.
I love it.
This is all part and parcel, though, of the World Cup becoming more competitive, because we've never had more ridiculous results, so that your crazy predictions end up becoming true.
Stupid thing.
Yeah. You read the Japan result was stupid and it came through.
See, it's said in jest. It bothers him.
No, it doesn't bother me at all.
No.
It's the spirit of the game, and that's what I respect.
Those are not your spirit of the game.
Let me tell you a little inside something now.
We can watch if John has any kind of emotional reaction to this or not. But John and I play Rocket League with one of our good friends. And our good friend, not very good at the game, yeah, bless him, he tries very hard, but he's not that good. And when he plays on my team, we win pretty regularly. And when he plays on John's team, all you can hear is John saying, why don't you do this when you're on anyone else's team? Yeah, the world's against you, isn't it, buddy?
The world is against me, but yeah. I do respect the way that you play this game.
Thank you.
You play it from the heart, unlike JJ Bull.
That's true. I play with the true spirit of the game.
Yeah, exactly.
I do. I embrace the chaos. There we go. Fine. Well, listen, JJ Bull, cheating is no longer working for him. He's in second place. He's going to have to find a new strategy to approach this with. And let's see if his predictions for tomorrow can aid him in developing his winning technique further. But Seb Stafford-Blore, another round of applause, Seb. I think it's the first time you've ever been first this deep. Yeah? Well done.
Thank you very much.
Well done.
Thank you very much.
Cool. Well, Seb, thank you for coming.
Thanks, Joe Devine.
And John McKenzie, thanks for coming.
Yes, I was contractually obliged, but you're welcome.
Yeah, great, man.
It's her little face.
he's the goblin here. Did he get on camera?
We got him to do it.
Was he on the camera? Oh, switch back to him and do it.
No, it's one
time.
Of those things where you can't ever see it. It's like the Doctor Who episode where the statues move.
It was funny. He did this with his hands. Okay, cool. Don and Craig, thank you very much. Thank you to editor Nathan for all of your hard work. And is that it? Yes, it is. Goodbye. We'll be back again tomorrow with JJ Bull. And it says a special treat for Monday and Tuesday, the first of the games before the final break, the games before the first two break days. Seb is going back to Germany, and it'll be me, John, and JJ. So look forward to a tactical affair. Yes? For now, au revoir, tschüss. Auf Wiedersehen. Goodbye.